Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. How can students, parents, and professors get the most out of higher education? Going off to college is one of the biggest life decisions that a person can make. Then those student loans start to pile up, and then there's that question, will there be a good paying job waiting for me after I get out of the graduation line? In his new book, a tenured professor gives a behind-the-scenes look at the American university system, what works, what doesn't, and how to get the most out of your higher education journey. We're joined by Jacques Berlinerbau. He is a Georgetown University professor and the author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Jacques, welcome to The Source.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing great. So you're looking specifically through the eyeballs of professors and how professors are groomed and put in the classroom. Either they're tenured or they're adjuncts, and why that makes a big difference.
Yeah, because the professors are the pivot point, right? Put it this way, a good or bad college education is going to be predicated on many things, but more than anything else, it's about that contact between undergraduates and their professors. We tend to forget that. So I really wanted to put the scholars front and center, for better or for worse.
You make a case that students should know up front if they're getting an adjunct or if they're getting a tenured professor when they sign up for a class.
Yeah, I think that's correct. The one proviso is adjuncts are often great teachers. The problem is that adjuncts are those who are not on the tenure track, and maybe we'll go over that in a bit, David, what that means, because I find a lot of people don't understand that. But the adjuncts are often overworked, underpaid, mistreated. They lack job security. And my view is after a while, it starts to grind on them. Even their tremendous professionalism is overcome by how difficult a job it is to excel in when the working conditions are so terrible.
Yeah, they usually have an office, three of them in a closet or something like that.
If they have an office at all. I've heard of adjuncts that conduct office hours in cafeterias in front of the library on a bench. That's kind of hard if you're up in New England. So the working conditions are deplorable, and the treatment, the sort of the lack of honor or esteem that is granted towards them is really demoralizing for these folks.
So let's go over that ranking system. What is it about an adjunct? What should I, you know, what do I need to know about somebody? So he's an adjunct. Well, I don't know what that means.
So there's this riff in the book that Americans completely misunderstand the rigid hierarchies that exist amongst professors, and it's not their fault per se. It's a very sort of obtuse thing. So let me try to explain to your listeners what these ranks actually mean. And stop me along the way, David, if I get too out of sorts. So,
yeah, but anyway, so before you get started, I just want to explain one thing. So typically, you know, I get a lot of professors and academics coming through here, and they give me their titles, and it's, you know, assistant professor to this and that and the other thing. And I say, you're a professor, okay? We're going to put you on the air. I'm not going to get into all this if you're an instructor or a professor or whatever, tenured. People don't care. They just want to know that you work in a classroom and you're at a college.
Yeah, but we care. I mean, we comment
but
on
yeah,
titles.
Once you're inside the cult, yeah, you care.
We covet our titles to an almost preposterous extent, which is why we're such a funny brood. All right, tenure. In 1940, we created a system, the American Association of University Professors, and it basically goes like this. You're hired to a tenure-track job, and you've got 6 years to prove your mettle, almost always by producing a tremendous amount of research. And if you make it through and the committees accept you, you have lifetime employment, complete academic freedom, a pretty good salary, and you've achieved the highest good of our noble profession. That's called being on the tenure line. So that's good, David, right? Sounds good.
Yeah.
The problem is that since the 70s, the number of tenure lines has been decreasing steadily. So the overwhelming majority of professors in the United States, something like 75%, never get to even vie on the tenure track. They're what are known as contingent faculty. Sometimes they're called adjuncts, which means they have no job security. They don't get good salaries. On the contrary, they live usually at the poverty line. They're overworked. This is very important. They have no academic freedom protections, so they're not protected by the right to say whatever they think is true. and important in class. So they really labor under extremely difficult circumstances. And those are the folks, even at the elite schools, especially at the elite schools, that we're putting in front of the great American undergraduate.
But it's not just either or, tenure or adjunct. You also have professors who are in good standing, who may have contracts for 2, 3, 4, 5 years at the campus, and you know they don't really have tenure, but still they're in high regard.
Right. Those are the non-tenure track full-time professors, and that's a category that has ballooned, as I point out in the book, over the last 5 or 10 years. It has ballooned conspicuously because it seems like college administrators are intent on getting rid of tenure. That's a widespread feeling in the Guild that in 20 years tenure won't exist anymore. And I'm sure there are people in your audience that are saying, so what's wrong with that?
Well, then what is wrong with that?
Well, if we get rid of tenure on Tuesday, we'll get rid of academic freedom on Wednesday. We've never figured out a way to protect scholars in the classroom from the intrusions of people that don't like what they're saying. So if we as Americans value this right for people who are experts and have earned the right to speak about their subject matter in front of students, if we value that as a right, that's going to be completely thrown out the window if and when we get rid of tenure. Now, I want to be very clear. I'm on the fence on this. There are a lot of problems with tenure. It doesn't serve scholars. It doesn't serve students. But if there's one really rock-solid argument for maintaining this institution, it's the very noble cause of free speech by credentialed experts. That's important.
Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Now, people are going to pick up this book thinking, I'm going to spend all of this money on sending my kid to a school. I want to make sure that they are going to get not just a good education, but an education that's going to help provide them with a good life. So tell us about that.
That's probably where we are not succeeding as well as we should. That kind of initiative to key the success of a college education to where one is working 3 or 5 years after they graduate, I feel that's rather new, and it's being pushed to a great extent by Democratic and Republican state legislatures. So this is a new way of thinking about the value of a college education. And we're not reacting to it fast enough, as far as I can tell, right? We're not, as professors, thinking about what that means, especially those of us in the humanities and the interpretive social sciences. STEM disciplines are different. I mean, those types of courses of training do usually lead to jobs, as far as I can tell. The problem is that professors haven't been able to make the case that studying literature or art history or philosophy or political science is as important, nay, if not more important, than studying a STEM discipline.
Well, the STEM discipline parts of the university campus seem to be doing really well, that there's a need for these graduates, and when they graduate, they can pretty much they can find a job. And right. But when you graduate with your art history degree, you know, unless you have very good connections and you've done a lot of internships and you're able to put yourself on the path of getting a job, you know, writing, you're going to be working at Starbucks.
This is a problem, right? This is a problem. Now, I do.
And you have all those loans.
Right. And you have all those loans, right? So what is our response as a guild, right? How do we, the humanists and interpretive social scientists of America, respond to that? We haven't. We've been talking a lot about critical thinking, which is almost a cliche now. If I say critical thinking to you, David, you probably start yawning because we've been saying that for 20 years. Oh, we teach them critical thinking skills. Critical thinking skills are really important, don't get me wrong, and it makes for a great worker and a more committed worker. But we have to start developing a new rationale and a new way of selling what it is that we're offering these kids in the classroom. And that's where we failed as a guild.
So there was a study in 2011, resulted in a book, Academically Adrift, found that 1/3 of college students made no gains in their writing, complex reasoning, or critical thinking skills after 4 years of college.
Mm. Yeah, I know it well. Depressing, and probably true. And maybe the number is a little low. It might be even higher, if you ask me.
So then, who's responsible for that failure?
That's on us. That's on the professors. That is a faculty that has given up on the noble vocation of teaching undergraduates. This is a trend decades in the making. We honor and reward those scholars who produce the most peer-reviewed scholarly research. And teaching is something of an afterthought. So it's not surprising that with that set of priorities, we're looking at that sort of data outcome in the famous academically adrift studies. That's on us. That's our fault.
What about student evaluations and how important those are?
Professors hate them. Professors hate them because
no kidding.
We feel that students don't look at what's really, really important. So I have a reputation of being, I hope I can say this on radio, something of a hard ass, right? I'm a tough grader. I'm really in your face. I destroy your essays, usually, unless they're written like John Updike or Philip Roth. So students tend to punish professors that engage in that sort of real tough love approach to them in the classroom. That's why professors dislike student evaluations. Often students look at silly things like how attractive a professor is and so on and so forth. So I wouldn't put too much stock in student evaluations, though I wouldn't completely ignore them.
But
either.
But the administration pays a lot of attention to them.
Professors feel, whether we're right or wrong, we feel that administrations use those, they're called SETs, students' evaluations of teaching. We feel that the administrations use SETs as a sort of trump card. A way of getting us off the tenure track or a way of firing us if we're not on the tenure track. So the tests, the instrument is used very, very cynically, and there are probably better ways of measuring if a professor is doing his or her job in the classroom.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and take some phone calls. James, we're going to get you on the air when we come back from this break. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. We're talking about Campus Confidential, how college works or doesn't for professors, parents, and students. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Coming up, we got a new academic year starting, and that means a new crop of new high school graduates heading off to college. Will they be prepared for taking on the challenges of life with skills and critical thinking, or will they drop out without degrees or not really educated to a point where anyone wants to hire them? And whose fault is that? We're talking about the book Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students, with Jacques Berlinbaugh. And let's go to the calls with James. James, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon, David. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I really like this topic. In fact, this hits home for me. My dad was a college professor for a lot of years until he fell from grace, as we say, moved into administration. But in any case, my question for your caller about an earlier point he made regarding tenure and the relationship between tenure and academic freedom and the argument for keeping tenure to maintain academic freedom. And my question is, why do you need one to have the other? I guess, in other words, is it possible to decouple those and make academic freedom for professors the standard, regardless of whether or not that professor has tenure? Thank you for the call.
James, thanks for the call. Thanks for the question. So, Jacques, go ahead.
Yeah, great question, James. Somebody actually, I wish I had the site. It's in my file somewhere. I guess you don't want me to go pouring through my files right now. Somebody actually kind of did the thought experiment. Is there a way to defend academic freedom without tenure? And the scholar who was doing it, the name will come back to me in a moment, really wanted to find a way to suggest that you could do it. And he couldn't find a way to defend that very, very peculiar right. Now, the STEM disciplines, I want to be clear, James, that the STEM disciplines aren't really putting out there a lot of controversial or combustible material, right? But it's the professors who work in literature, cinema, philosophy, political science, sociology, anthropology. We do tend to say things, because of the nature of what we study, that make us very, very vulnerable to people on the left and on the right, in positions of power, who really don't want to hear hear our hot takes anymore in the classroom. So I do think that tenure is absolutely necessary to defending academic freedom, though I do wish we would conduct an experiment in which we tried to find other ways that might defend that right.
All right, another caller, Tyler. Tyler, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I just wanted to speak, just kind of put out a talking point. I'm a recent master's graduate from UTSA, and one of the things that kind of underlies this entire conversation, and I think that it's an important point, is that students are consumers, and this massive consumer mentality is bleeding into all kinds of, you know, student culture. So, for example, he mentioned that he's a tough grader, and I think that one of the major problems is that more professors should be tough graders. But the problem is that when the students and our grader culture is this consumer nightmare, then, you know, it becomes this confrontational thing where it's like, how dare you grade me toughly? How, you know what I mean? When it's that relationship between an expert and a learner, I think, is being eroded by this underlying massive consumerist thing. So,
all right, Tyler, good points. Thank you for calling in, sir. So, Jacques, your reaction?
Great question, but I mean, I accept the comment that they're very consumer-oriented. They're also very pre-professional. That's the word we're using now. I do think, however, that every generation of professors has complained about every generation of students. I mean, I know that for a fact, reading campus novels. There's this long-running history of professors looking out in their lecture halls and saying, oh, what a bunch of schnooks. I can't believe these kids. This is what's wrong with them. I kind of think the Hippocratic oath of a professor is, I shall teach 18 to 24-year-olds, no matter how annoying or shallow they might be. So I agree with Tyler that there is this irritating, overarching consumerism that characterizes this generation of millennials. By the same token, that's our job, right? We sign up to become professors, I would hope, because we want to educate people. So there's not much we can do with the complaint other than to say, well, this is what we're confronted with. These are some of their challenges as learners, and this is what we have to help them overcome in the classroom.
So when it comes to being a tough grader and having high expectations for students, doesn't that also require that the professor be ready to have a lot of office hours and be ready to talk to students and show them precisely why that those grades aren't what they thought they should be?
It's a massive investment of time. This type of teaching, especially when you're working on essays and correcting their compositional style, and you just have to sit side by side with them, there's no app that can do it. And I just want to remind listeners that a tenure-line professor, a person who's going up for tenure, just doesn't have the time to do this, right? That time, 1 minute past office hours, those 90 minutes a week of office hours, you're back in the archive. You're back in the library because you're researching for the next 40 years of your life. You're trying to assure a livelihood for your family. So our priorities are all askew. They're all upside down.
And you talk about in your book the difference between campuses. We have these prestigious campuses with these high brand names that everyone wants to go to, these dream schools. And then we have smaller liberal art colleges that are scattered across the nation that are dealing with a shrinking contraction student population. And they have meetings and consultants who come in and talk about student retention. And you better not let these students go away because you need them to stay afloat.
So what I try to do in the book is I try to suggest for parents and high school seniors ways of thinking about certain categories of colleges that I feel will really offer value. And these are not the elite usual suspects. So a couple of things to look at. Small liberal arts colleges can be an absolute disaster or they can be an absolute dream, especially if they are redoubling their commitment to teaching and getting their entire faculty, incentivizing their faculty to be there for the students. Another thing I look at, David, with tremendous fondness are honors colleges. And this is kind of a new development in American higher education. These are carved out institutions. Usually it's something that is pulled out of a larger institution. And what the provost or the dean does is they get the best teachers in the entire school and they concentrate them in this smaller school called an honors college or an honors academy. So that's a great benefit, and it's also a value, because often these units have a huge war chest, and they can offer scholarships so they can compete for some of the better students usually in the state. So I would look at state schools that have honors colleges. I visited a few of them, and I'm extremely impressed by what they're offering undergraduates.
Another caller, Kamala. And Kamala, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm curious to read this book, and I think that there's a lot of real important issues here. As someone who's taught for a couple decades at all of the levels you're talking about, but I guess my concern is making dichotomies between things like research and teaching, and things like being an adjunct and being a tenure-track professor, because I understand that the resources are very different and that there's this fight for resources that we all have, but I think within that, we're all trying to work together as, in the best situation anyway, as faculty and as students to come together to provide something that is sort of unique and distinctive and is not just about getting a future job with lots of money. And I just wanted you to comment on that, because I think we're on a similar trajectory on that, but I was a little leery of all the binaries and the idea that adjuncts can't do a good job and that parents should be leery of them.
All right, Kamala, thank you for that. And so, Jacques.
Oh, I'm a big defender of adjuncts, so perhaps I misspoke. So I was an adjunct for 7 years, so I went through the experience. And if you read the book, what you'll see is my sense is they actually do a better job in the classroom than the tenure line professors. The problem is, as I mentioned earlier, they tend to get worn down by the absolutely deplorable working conditions that they're confronted with. On research and teaching, I don't think it's a binary. I think what we lost as professors is we talk about work-life balance. We lost the idea of research-teaching balance, especially for those on the tenure track. The idea became you research and you research and you research, and the teaching is this afterthought or something that you try to become excused from, or you try to get out of your teaching responsibilities. My professor of the future, assuming I could engineer such a creature, would really be somebody that starts to explore the organic links between doing research and bringing that into the classroom in a way that's relevant to undergraduates. It's been tried before, but I don't think we've tried hard enough. So I'm all for research-teaching balance. I wouldn't think of it as a binary.
So would you tell a recent high school graduate who's thinking about going to college, what would you recommend them to do?
First thing is I want to know the kid. I just want to know who they are. I want to know if they have ADHD. I want to know if they have self-esteem issues.
They all do.
You know, yeah.
We all do.
I don't know. Some of them, you know, you get kids that go to religious colleges or military academies, and they like really, really hard professors that are mean with them. They like being tased by stun guns, right? So the most important thing when you're talking to a kid about what college is, who are you, kiddo? All right, let's take an honest assessment and inventory of your talents and skills and your lack of talent and your lack of skills, and then let's begin our quest to find the proper college. So I can't think of any general advice I'd give them, except for small class size, which I emphasize in the book. Look for a school where the classes are not massified and the professor is able to work with you on some sort of individual level.
Jacques Berliner Blah, he is the author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. It was great talking with you.
Thank you, David. That was fun.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.